Today on Vox Talks Economics, do pandemics have a lasting effect on inequality? And what does that tell us about the long-term impact of COVID-19? Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. Every week we bring you the most interesting new research in economics, and make sure you subscribe to us on your podcast platform. My name is Tim Phillips. Over the last year, Vox Talks Economics has been covering the impact of COVID-19 on rich and poor, and it's clear that many of the most vulnerable in society have also been the biggest losers so far. But what do previous epidemics tell us about whether those new gaps between the haves and have-nots will persist? That's the subject of a new CEPR discussion paper. Jonathan Ostrey of the IMF and CEPR is one of the authors. Jonathan, welcome to Vox Talks Economics.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Now, Jonathan, am I right to claim, as I did, that the immediate impact of COVID-19 on income inequality has, generally speaking, been regressive?
I think that is right. That is the message from our study. But I mean, you'd be forgiven for wondering a little bit, because right at the beginning, when the pandemic first erupted in the initial months, we had a lot of press articles talking about heroes and how they could command higher wages, the frontline workers, the hospital workers, the cashiers. And I think the bottom line is that those kind of headlines were short-lived. And as the months unfolded, we came to realize, both with more anecdotal evidence and more systematic study, that COVID-19 was going to raise inequality.
But on the other hand, there are many economies in which there has been quite a generous temporary policy response. How well has that offset those impacts?
I think it's been absolutely essential. It's been essential on so many levels. What we've learned is that countries that really pulled out all the stops on fiscal and monetary policy are those that suffered a less deep recession and really avoided depressions. And those countries where policy space was more constrained seemed to suffer more. So those transfers, those measures to keep households afloat, to keep businesses afloat, were absolutely essential. And I would say that even where fiscal space was very scarce, some countries have handled that better than others and have avoided some really bad outcomes thanks to policy support. And we document some of that, not in the paper we're talking about today, but in some complementary work that focuses especially on the role of policy.
This is a kind of a what next paper, isn't it? And I suppose one of the things that we all hope happens next is that the pandemic dies down and economies are going to start to grow again. When that happens, what mechanisms, when that happens, might lead to a lasting change in this inequality? Why doesn't it just fix itself?
Don't forget that inequality was on the rise, had a rising trend long before this pandemic in many countries, including where I'm sitting and where you're sitting. So this is a long-standing problem that has been exacerbated, as your preamble suggested, by this epidemic. And there is a sort of school of thought in economics that says, if we just get growth going, inequality will take care of itself. Have a bigger pie, and everyone will get not necessarily a bigger share, but will get something from it. And what I think we've learned over the years from many researchers, and I have a book on this called Confronting Inequality that's a couple years old that develops this in more detail, is that inequality rarely takes care of itself. So what inequality needs, like many policy targets, it needs policy instruments applied to that target to make headway. You know, it is a dangerous gamble to assume that if we simply get the economy growing again, inequality will take care of itself. It will surely help, but I don't think it will take care of itself. And what we have learned in past pandemics, all the pandemics this century that we have analyzed, is that the impact on inequality actually gets worse over time. We look at a five-year horizon, and inequality rises immediately, but it rises even more over time, suggesting that the, you know, all the goodwill that is generated in support of the frontline workers, the so-called heroes at the beginning of a crisis, might well peter out. And just as before the crisis, those pernicious trends then reassert themselves in the aftermath. So we do need consistent policy support. We do need to, in places where policy space is scarce, we need to prioritize vigorously in favor of those who are more disadvantaged in society, lest their plight become even worse as it was before the pandemic.
Let's talk about specifically what's in this paper. You've investigated the long-run impact of other pandemics, haven't you? Now, how far do you go back in history here? And how do you decide which events you're going to include and which ones you exclude?
As I mentioned earlier, we looked at all the pandemics this century, you know, things like swine flu, MERS, Zika, Ebola, all of those things. Obviously, all of these pandemics differ from the current pandemic in that they are less severe in terms of cases and in terms of deaths. They are less global, though H1N1 was a global pandemic, but the others are more localized. So the question is really, what can we learn from the past epidemic/pandemics from this century? We use data that goes back further, but all of the episodes, we don't exclude any, are the ones that transpired where the WHO declared that there was an epidemic or a pandemic this century. And I think it's in our favor that these past episodes are much less severe than the present one, because if policymakers had a tough time avoiding the inequality impacts of these much less severe pandemics, it's going to be an even taller, more severe order for them to do better this time round. So if we find effects from those past less severe pandemics, given that this one is kind of at the 99th percentile of our sample, this one is many times, maybe 17 or 18 times more severe than the typical pandemic in our sample. I'm not assuming linearity, but the effects are likely to be also much more severe. But I can also say something about the robustness of these results, if that's appropriate.
Yes, that's really what I was going to ask you, yes, about the data that you're using for this and how much credibility that you give to these results based on that.
Well, causality, robustness is always the big challenge in macroeconomics, and it's one that we needed to confront in this study. The way we went about it was we tried to check robustness along many different dimensions. The first, as you pointed out, is on data. Inequality is very difficult to measure, and there's a huge debate in our profession about the quality of inequality data. The way we address it is that we use many different sources, many different databases. So our baseline database on inequality is Fred Solt's SWID database, but you know, we're not wedded to it. It's the most comprehensive and both in time and cross-section database that exists in the world today. But there's also the WIS database, there's the LIS database, there's, you know, the World Bank's data. There are many different databases. They all have different coverage and different samples. We use them all. We use data on not just inequality, not just in Gini's from all these different sources, but also incomes by deciles, top and bottom measured 1, 10, 20, 40, however you want. We also focused on the employment consequences because that's an important aspect, an important mediation channel through which inequality is affected. People lose their jobs and they do so to differing degrees based on the different skill levels, education levels that they have. And the permanence of those job losses is very different for low-skilled workers and for people like you and me that have high level of skills and education. So that's one dimension that we look at for robustness. The second is the empirical method, the econometric method. And we don't innovate. We use local projections to generate impulse responses. That is a well-established method. But we also use ADL methods from Romer and Romer on their work on fiscal policy. So we do different econometric methods. And finally, there is always the possibility of two sources of endogeneity. There's omitted variable bias and there's reverse causality. We have a baseline model, but we also have many alternative specifications with additional controls. There are many other things going on in the world during this period that might have impacted inequality, and we try and internalize that literature in our specification. And then, of course, you know, there's this question of, are the countries where the pandemic was more severe, are there other aspects of those economies, other pre-existing characteristics that might cause those countries to have a higher effect of the pandemic than in countries where the pandemic was less severe? So this is investigating this parallel trend assumption. Were the trends in inequality essentially similar in countries across our sample? And one way of addressing that is a placebo test. And we run some of that work and find that indeed, if we distribute pandemics randomly through the data, the impulse responses show absolutely nothing. So that's encouraging as far as the parallel trend assumption is concerned. And then we look also at reverse causality, at the possibility that inequality is driving the pandemic rather than the pandemic driving inequality. Now, when you think of the dummy variable, the WHO declaring a pandemic, it doesn't smell bad in the sense that it's hard to imagine that past levels of inequality would be driving that declaration. But when you think of, you know, the severity of the pandemic, it's easier to understand that reverse causality. There may well be characteristics of the country that make it more prone to experience a more severe pandemic. And there are different approaches. One is the Jordan Taylor and the Economic Journal approach to try and get at average treatment effects when different characteristics may be impinging the data and work like this. And we run some of that work, and our results are remarkably similar, indeed stronger, when we account for this potential reverse causality. And then finally, we can think of an instrumental variable technique where what we need is the interaction of a global variable like the WHO declaration with some country-specific variable like average temperature, urbanization, things like that that are known and documented to affect the transmission of pandemics to various macro variables and to inequality. So we do all of that. We get, if anything, stronger effects when we deliberately account for reverse causality than in the OLS. So that's how we handle that.
So having done all of that, Jonathan, historically, what is the size and the length of the impact of a pandemic on inequality? Can we put a number on it?
Yeah, it's actually not just statistically significant, but it's economically large. Remember that inequality is a very slow-moving variable. It moves up along its path, but it moves only a fraction of a Gini point every year. And so the way to think of the size is really to think of it in terms of the standard deviation of the variable in question. And the average pandemic in our sample, and remembering that these pandemics are much smaller than what we're going through today, is about 1.5 standard deviations of the Gini. The average 5-year impact for a much smaller pandemic is 1.5 standard deviations of the Gini's standard deviation in our sample. So it is a large impact. I think Tony Atkinson used to say that if it's like less than a standard deviation, don't worry about it. But if it's more, it's something that should be thought about. So I think it passes the economic significance. And it's something, as I say, that builds. And it's also interesting, I don't want to push this too far, but we can look, because of the SWID database, we can look at both market Gini's and net Gini's. And I think if you asked a random sample of economists, you'd think, well, it ought to be the case that the impact on the post-tax and transfer Gini's is smaller than the impact on the pre-tax and transfers.
Absolutely.
Because
makes
the
sense,
government is trying to fix this problem. We don't actually find this in the data. As I said, I don't want to push it too far, but it suggests something that we do need to look more at in the future.
Now, one other thing that you looked at is the impact on inequality by level of education. What additionally does this tell us?
We touched on this a little bit before. So the ILO produces very useful data on employment and job losses, essentially, by different skill level, proxied by different educational achievement level. And what it shows is that people like you and me, we don't suffer any job losses in an event like this. Our jobs are safe. We're doing essentially the same thing as we used to do. It's just that we're doing it from home instead of from the office. But for people with less skill levels, you know, only a basic education, they suffer job losses, and then those jobs don't seem to come back. So they seem to disappear for the long haul. And the reason that's important for inequality is that we know that temporary shocks to people at the bottom can easily morph into much more permanent, more life-changing results. The trampoline has less of a bounce back for those folks. And without deliberate policy interventions to help those at the bottom with basic skills through retraining, through active labor market policies and income support, it's very difficult for those people to bounce back on their own. Now, of course, we're all reading the headlines. For example, in the United States, the economy is running hot. The bargaining power of labor is going up, including those at the bottom. People who flip burgers at McDonald's are quitting their jobs and doing something else. That's great. And I mean that sincerely. That is great because the bargaining power of labor was very much on the bad end of things in the run-up to this crisis. But again, we don't know how long that will last. And so it's something to watch.
We are talking now as if pandemics are one type of crisis that are separate from every other type of crisis. Is this true? Is the inequality response to a pandemic different to any other type of crisis?
We did look at this question. We wanted to ask whether big events like deep recessions, when GDP actually declines, or different kinds of financial crises, whether they exert similar impacts on inequality. Unlike for the pandemic literature, there is a much broader literature on the distributional effects of recessions and crises. So we are doing this as a kind of point of comparison rather than diving deeply into that issue. But what we find is that the pandemic's effect on inequality is much more pronounced. It is larger and more significant. And there are probably good reasons for that. Just looking at financial crisis as a counterpoint, you know, a financial crisis is one where the financial income rather than labor income is probably the one that's going to take the biggest hit. But the people who have more financial income are probably the rich. So that could be one reason why the inequality effects of financial crises are not that big. Plus, of course, there's a policy response that's factored in, and that may help the rich more than the poor, especially on the monetary policy side. So, you know, again, I'm not pressing that point, but I am saying that there are big differences. The impact of the pandemic on inequality in the data that we have is much larger and more significant than for these other types of events.
Do you remember the middle of 2020, we were all discussing what letter of the alphabet the recovery would resemble, whether it be a U or a V or a W or an L. And one of those that came up was the K-shaped recovery, where it's good for some people, not so good for others. It sounds like, at least the data you're looking at, that this K-shaped recovery is what we're getting. Does this mean that there are specific policies that we should be thinking about enacting in the near future to improve outcomes?
Yeah, I think I agree with the way you put it on both your statement and where your question was going. So on your statement, this is indeed the K-shaped recovery that we worried about. Mm. And it's K-shaped on many different dimensions. We are seeing growing divergence across countries. As you know, the one bright spot in the inequality landscape before the pandemic was kind of this greater convergence between poor countries and rich countries, in the sense that some of the emerging market giants were growing faster in per capita income terms than the rich countries. And that's what you want to see. You want to see that convergence. And that's been put into reverse in this pandemic for two reasons. One is that poorer countries have, in general, had less policy space than richer countries. And so they've been less able to counteract the impact on the macro economy with policy measures. And the second is that the pandemic as a health crisis has been more severe by and large in middle income and poor countries than it has in rich countries. Of course, there are exceptions. And so that's the second reason for the divergence. And then there is divergence, the K-shaped recovery within countries. The poor have been hit harder. And so the answer to the policy point is implicit in everything I just said. You need to first get the pandemic under control, which in this world of other Greek letters with beta and delta means you need to get your folks vaccinated, and we need more vaccine sharing. We need more availability of vaccines in poor and middle income countries. And we need to make sure that debt burdens that have resulted from this pandemic through no fault of the countries themselves do not become oppressive in the period ahead. So we will need more concessional financing. We will need quite likely restructurings and other ways to make the debt burden less severe in the years ahead. And that will underscore the need for greater multilateral cooperation to bring that about.
Well, let's hope we see some of those policies in the near future. But meanwhile, Jonathan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim.
Now, you want to read this paper, and it is called Will COVID-19 Have Long-Lasting Effects on Inequality? Evidence from Past Pandemics. And the authors are Davide Furceri, Prakash Lungani, Jonathan Ostri, and Pietro Pizzuto. It is discussion paper 16122 at the CEPR. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. Every week we bring you the most important, latest research. And if you want to know what you'll be reading in journals 18 months from now, well, listen to Vox Talks Economics today. For previews and additional features, follow Vox Talks Economics on Instagram. And there are 12 years of Vox Talks Economics at voxeu.org/voxtalks.